Accession number 18202, Reel 5.
Files Reel 5.
These dancers that we used to have regularly in the messes, and there were even, we'd built outside dance floor with little arbors and things around, and it was all very nice. And incidentally, there's another thing that occurs to me. I remember we had a very big ball one time during the winter, and it was very, very cold in Austria, particularly at that time, and there was a whole month that we didn't fly at all because there was so much snow on the ground. And we got one of the hangars, old German hangars that wasn't being used, and we turned this into a ballroom. And it was the amount of stuff that we had to create warmth in there was quite fantastic. And we had all this boarding floor, which was sanded down and that. But that's perhaps another story. It was just an achievement. When Hermy was asked by her one or two of her pals, why don't you come with us to the Elfhead, to the Selfegg station, which was only, what, I don't know, 5 or 6 kilometres from her hometown of Knittelfeld. And she sort of thought, well, why shouldn't I? These other friends of hers used to come along regularly. We'd send a three-tonner, put some more comfortable seats in the back and go and collect these girls if they wanted to come and then take them back at the end of the evening. And she'd heard about these things but wasn't very interested. And then she came to this one thing, was dancing with a fellow, I remember his name, but I shan't mention it, as one of our NCO pilots, like me. And his name was Ken. he wasn't getting on terribly well with her. And I know he came back into the mess where Johnny Howard and I were not interested in the dance, but we were having a bit of a little private thrash of our own. And so what happened to that blonde you had on your arm earlier on in the evening? She was good-looking, my wife said, very good-looking. And Ken said, oh, yeah, she's a bit of a misery. She won't play, or some words to that effect, or she's not very interested in me, you see. So I said, you mean that she's in there alone? Well, she's got one of her friends with her. I said, right, and I was over there like a shot, you see. And we never looked back from that time onwards, I'm pleased to say. But again, that's the start of another story.
What was the attitude of the commanding officer towards your getting married to an Austrian?
Very well, very good. No problems at all. Well, I mean, after all, he had met Hermy already, you see, and subsequent to my meeting her. But, no, he was a good fellow, Pete Otterwill. He was our new CO. He must have been, a few inches over 6 feet. Terribly burnt, scarred face, which he would never talk about. No gallantry decorations, but lots of campaign medals. Wonderful pilot. He used to have to bend his head down before he could close the hood on the Spitfire. He was so tall. And he... Again, I digress, but before we broke up and went back to... No, wait a minute, what were we doing? Yes, before the squadron broke up in Austria... No, I beg your pardon, we didn't break up in Austria. We went back to Italy. But before we left Austria, he was flying a lot with us, and he was taking us in tight formations and doing very, very steep turns. Exceptionally steep turns. And when we finally did break up in Italy, he said, if I'd had you another month, you chaps, he said, we'd have been doing a formation roll, which was something unheard of at that time. And the interesting thing about this was, although we'd never got to this point, one of our flight commanders, that's Benny Bennett, Flight Lieutenant Benny Bennett, I read in one of the flying magazines a year or so after we got home, he was with 50. It's either 54 Squadron or 57 Squadron at Odium, which is in Hants. And they were actually doing various aerobatic manoeuvres in formation. And this was very nearly the start of Royal Air Force aerobatic formation flying. Excuse me. And I'm sure that Benny Bennett would have had a lot to do with it when he went to Odium, because they were on Vampires. Excuse me. They were on Vampires, and Benny would have remembered all this effort that Pete Ottawa was making. So that was interesting in that respect. In April, the squadron was more or less broken up. So in April 47, it's now 1947, I'd married Hermia on the 28th of February. I'd pranged on the 14th of February, married Hermia on the 28th of February, and taken her back to Italy. We were breaking up, probably in the April. The only other thing that happened to me that was of interest, I feel, before we started breaking up, was that an exercise we had with the next wing at Udine, which was, let me think, I think it was 239 wing, they had their wing commander flying, was a chap called Storer, Jazz Storer, James Storer, who subsequently I met as a very well-known veterinary surgeon in Chester, and who, after the war, had been CEO of the local City of Chester Auxiliary Squadron, that's 610. And he was Wing Commander Flying of 239 Wing. Our Wing Commander Flying was a chap called Cassidy, so his nickname was Hopalong. And we'd had this exercise between the two wings. We started about 6 o'clock in the morning and were due to finish at midday. And our wing, I'm sorry to say, did not distinguish themselves. No one really saw anything. No one claimed anything. We were armed, of course, just with... well, we were armed because there was lots of trouble, even in those days, with the Yugoslavs who wanted Trieste. And we used to have to do the Morgan Line patrol morning and night to show the flag to the Yugoslavs. But this particular exercise was full air exercise, and no one saw anything. But just before 12 o'clock, when I was thinking of turning around and going home, I was flying alone, and quite by accident, because I should have had my wits about me, I happened to turn my head as I turned, and I saw a Mustang coming in very fast indeed. They were quite a bit faster than our Spit 9s. And so I pulled everything out and pulled the old Spitty round on a sixpence, which you could do, especially when you chop the throttle. And he flashed by underneath me. Obviously, I hadn't got a bead on me, but I was able to come round again, back again, pull her back, and get a very, very good camera shot of this Mustang, which should have disintegrated if I'd had anything lethal in the guns. And that was that. Well, the debriefing, we were berated by our chap, Hopalong Cassidy. He called us all the names under the sun. He was glad there wasn't a war on, because we'd never have survived, we'd never have seen anything, we'd have never claimed anything or done anything worthwhile. We were a terrible lot. He said, and that's what I think of you. And he said, did anyone at all see anything? So I was the junior member, and I sort of coughed a bit like He said, yes, what did you do? I said, well, I said, I reckon I got a Mustang over the Piave just 5 minutes before midday. He said, yes, as a matter of fact, you did, he said, and it was the wing commander flying, and you're the only bloke who did anything at all. But it was really proof that the old Spitter, even though it wasn't as fast as those Mustangs, could literally, you know, sort of run rings around them in manoeuvrability, you see. And that Spitty, when you'd taken the revs right off, you could pull around so steeply that she was juddering, but she still wouldn't spin, you see. It's rather as I said earlier on. Anyway, that was just the last interesting thing, apart from these Morgan Line patrols that were quite interesting. The Yugoslavs used to fire at us, but only small arms, and we'd fly along this Morgan Line, which General Morgan had drawn on the map between Trieste and Gorizia. And occasionally, not very often, but occasionally, someone would say, you've been hit today, and that meant that there was usually a bullet hole through the tail or something like that. Nothing dangerous, but these chaps used to fire at you from the ground, especially if you were low down. And they were as bad then as they have been in these last few recent years. So then, I came home in April. I'd taken her down to Venice, where she joined up with other wives coming back, largely Italian wives, and they came back on a thing which was lovingly called the Medlock Brown train, which was a sort of family's train. I was not allowed to go and meet her at Dover, but I did. I just saw a gate crash my way down, and I wondered how I did it, but I did it. And I brought her back to London, and before the evening was out, every member of my family and every member of the local pub had fallen in love with her, and she was made. I mean, she was great. So that was a very happy ending. Just to finish with, it's of interest that after the war, as most people will know from those days, instruments of war such as aircraft were not very sought after. They were usually dumped. A lot of our stuff on the squadron was dumped in the river. One or two of the newer of the aircraft were kept and actually sold to the Italians. And the Italians, of course, they'd been good boys in dethroning Musso and that sort of thing. That's why they got Trieste. But they reformed their air force, the Regia Aeronautica, and they used Spitfires. Eventually, when they progressed beyond those, they sold what Spitfires were still airworthy to the Israelis. And in early 80s, the early 1980s, I think a fellow called Lamplu, he's quite well known in the veteran aircraft world, was in Israel and found on a kibbutz rubbish dump in the Gaza Strip the remains of a Spitfire. Not very much of it. Decided to have it shipped back to England, where Charles Church, the millionaire house builder from your part of the world, Conrad, you may know of Charles Church. He used to build, you know, sort of quarter and half million pound houses a few years ago. He bought it, and he had at that time a rather nice estate near Salisbury, and Micheldever there. Was it Winchester? I'm not sure, down that way. And he bought these remains. He had his own aircraft engineer and a rather nice little setup on his estate, small hangar, flying strip, and so forth. And he restored this particular Spitfire, restored it, and built in, at the same time, built into it two cockpits, because it was too valuable a thing to entrust to people as they did with us who'd never flown a Spitfire before. And that aircraft turned out to be PT, the serial number PT-462. And its squadron letters, our 253 letters, were SW, and the ident letter was A. Now, that didn't join the squadron until a month or two before the war finished. And it was therefore relatively new. I was amazed when a chap who was a volunteer worker with Dick Melton at Charles Church's place at Mitchell Deaver got on to me, because this lad was a Baconian, and said, "Do you realise we've got an aeroplane here that used to fly on your squadron?" And so I was very interested, and he gave me the details, but we never used to put, or very rarely used to put in our logbooks, the serial number of the aeroplane. It was just the identity letter, A or B or X or whatever it was. And I looked in my logbook, and I thought, I'm sure I've flown that aeroplane, because he told me it was SWA. And I contacted one or two chaps I was still in contact with to see if they had flown this aircraft and if they'd recorded the serial number without telling them what identity number it was and so forth. And two of them wrote back to me and identified beyond any reasonable doubt that this was an aircraft that I'd flown a couple of times on the squadron, but was generally flown by the CO, being a fairly new aircraft. And I remember very well, and again, I promise to finish this time, that that aircraft, I said earlier on that there was a whole month and we couldn't fly in Austria because there was so much snow on the runway. And this was the end of November when we stopped flying. And we went right through Christmas, still no flying. And then the last couple of days of 1946, they decided they would try to clear our strip, which was PSB tracking, at Zeltweg, of the snow. They got it down to about an inch or so, which unfortunately then froze over, and huge walls of snow blown up each side, and not a very long strip, seemed shorter than it was. And we were down at the flight there, and the CO, Pete Otterwill, said to me, Jack, as they called me in those days, will you take SWA up and see what the conditions are like? And I didn't say it, but I thought, what, me? You know, in my state of junior level. And yes, he said, just fly it round a bit and tell me what it's like, and then we'll decide whether we can fly generally. And so I felt quite bucked about this. In retrospect, I'm sure it's because I was the least expendable, or the most expendable, if you like, of the crowd. Anyway, I took this thing off. That was okay. And then flew it round about 20 minutes. The conditions weren't too bad. Very, very white, lots of snow. Mountains look a lot nearer, of course, especially the tops when there's snow on them. And came back to the airfield, landed the thing, taking great care not to use a brake, or at least as little as possible, because the whole of this strip, not only was it had huge banks of snow on each side, giving a sort of burying effect, but the actual snow that was still left on the PSB was quite hard and frozen, and anything could happen if you applied a bit of brake. But I got this thing down, taxied gingerly up to the end, and that was the only time that I got out of the aircraft to a round of applause, and then everyone took off after that. And I think that's a nice way to finish my long, long diatribe.